out of the majors for a few years?
Yes, I was traded to Los Angeles in the Pacific Coast League by the Boston Bees, and then drafted by the A's, the tail end of the 42 season.
I see. Do you remember how much they paid for you? I mean, was it
Oh,
just
I
a
think it was
straight
just the
bid?
regular draft price. I don't remember at that time just how much the draft price was, but compared to today's dollars, I don't think it was too much.
I know in the spring of 1943, the A's trained in Wilmington. Do you have any special memories of spring training in Wilmington?
Yes, I do. The weekend before the season opened, we had a runner in a rundown between home and third, and Bob Swift, the A's catcher, was running the runner back to third and threw the ball, and just as I reached for it, it hit the runner's head and just caromed off ever so slightly, and the ball hit me in the left eye and caused a retinal hemorrhage. I remember the season opened in Washington, and I had that big patch over the eye, and actually it did affect my hitting and sight until the following fall. To better explain it, there was a blind spot in one eye, and the muscles of accommodation didn't react with a moving object. And you can understand that it did affect
Sure.
my hitting, and I felt more at the ball instead of attacking it.
Now, Frank Skaff mentioned something about that, and I just want to check out his story with you. He said that one night, you're having trouble with your vision. I mean, it was unclear that one night you were just kind of sitting in a hotel room, your own room, and on the bed and kind of staring at the light at the ceiling, and all of a sudden it kind of went into focus. Is that true, or is he just elaborating?
No, it didn't happen during the season. Actually, it happened later that fall and winter, and pretty much as Frank did explain, that every morning when I awoke, the first thing I would look for would be that black or dark spot. And this one morning I awoke, and the spot disappeared, or I would say maybe 95% of it disappeared, and I was elated at that point.
Now, was this something like Tony Conigliaro had? I know he had a, or they feared that he'd have a blind spot, or at least a hole in the retina, but apparently it healed. I guess the skin just kind of came together, not
Well,
really.
Tony, I understand, was hit more in the cheek, where I was hit directly in the eye.
Oh, I
In
see.
fact, I carry a scar over the left eye. From what I understand, the impact of the ball pushed the eyeball itself back into whatever it touches there, and it caused a blood clot or a hemorrhage. I was treated by several doctors in Philadelphia, and at one point they even mentioned that they'd probably have to take the eyeball itself out and puncture these little blood clots. There were numerous clots in there, and puncture these to allow the blood to flow through. At that point, I told him I wasn't going, about to show up for that operation.
Sure, yeah, I can imagine. It sounds scary to
Yeah.
me. So I guess it's perhaps the wrong thing to ask you how the season went, because if you had that problem, it probably wasn't a very pleasant one.
No, it wasn't. Not only for myself, but also for the team. I remember during that season, or prior to the season, Connie Mack, who was then a manager, had a general meeting before the season opened, and he pointed out that it would only be fair that we'd all admit that there was not a chance for the Athletics to win the pennant that year.
Okay, that's
However,
fair enough.
that did not mean that all 25 men on the team could not contribute something. And every game above and beyond our normal capabilities would be just that one more game on a victory column. During the season, we had I believe we tied the American League record for 21 consecutive losses. And I'm not proud of that at all. We just tied the record. We could have gone on to break it beyond reach, or rather establish a record beyond reach, except for the one game we played in Chicago, and Bill Dietrich was pitching. And Bill, as you know, is an excellent fielder. And I started the inning off, and I must have beat out a missed third strike. I don't know how I got on first, but nonetheless, I was on first with no outs. The next batter, I bunted the ball. Dietrich pounced off the mound, picked up the ball, and threw towards second. But between pitcher's mound and second base stood Cal Hubbard with his 10-foot-wide shoulder blades. And the ball hit Hub in the back, and I was safe. Two of us were on, no outs. Next batter bunted the ball to get us over. And just as Dietrich reached for the ball, it took a little crazy hop over his hand, and all three runners were safe. I scored on a sacrifice fly, and we beat the White Sox 1-0. Uh-huh. Now, if it had not been for that play by Hubbard and that little crazy hop, we could have gone, or we actually lost 12 more ball games after that, so you can understand.
Did you really? Holy smokes.
You can understand how we would have had a record that I'm sure would have had a place in Cooperstown for a long, long time.
Sure. I know about that 20-game losing streak. In fact, Bert Kaczynski said you had one earlier. It wasn't long.
But I'm sure we had several of those losing streaks.
He left the team on July 5th or 6th, I think, and he said that in the 4 or 5 weeks he was with the team, he had just graduated from Penn and joined the team directly, that you had another one. I'm trying to think of other things that happened during that 43 season with the A's. I don't think there was too much else besides, of course, this is all history for me. I was born in 1945. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go on and talk about the Tigers. Now, how did you go to the Tigers after 43? Were you traded or something?
I was traded by the A's to their Louisville farm immediately after the 43 season. Mm-hmm. And then the Tigers drafted me from Louisville before I even reported, or that same fall.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you went to spring training with the Tigers in 44 then?
Yes.
Okay, now where was that? Was that Evansville or Terre Haute?
In Evansville.
Evansville.
Yes.
What was spring training like there? Well, wasn't that the cold spring, the snowy spring? Didn't they have a blizzard in 44?
I don't remember whether they did or not, but spring training above the Mason-Dixon line is not conducive to training and loosening up the muscles and getting ready for the season.
So you didn't care for it too much. Did you have to spend a lot of time indoors in Evansville, or was it mostly outdoors?
No, it was outdoors.
Wally Moses mentioned something. Now, it may have been in Terre Haute, but of course he was with the White Sox. But did the Tigers have to play ball on a golf course? Was the field laid out on a golf course? Or
no, it was a regular baseball diamond.
Oh, I see. Was it a school, like a college or a high school field? Or
no, it was a...
For the Three-I League. Wasn't Evansville in the Three-I League?
I don't know whether they were at that time or not. From 1932, when 11 leagues with 6 to 12 teams per league started us at the 32 season, and 51 leagues, that is minor leagues, started the season, 11 survived. So from 1932 on, it was pretty hard to keep in track with the leagues and the teams changing from one league to another.
Sure. Do you remember anything else specifically about Evansville?
No, I don't. No, nothing specific.
Okay, did
nothing
the Tigers
unusual.
Train there in 45 also?
No, that, gosh, I've forgotten. It could have been, yes. Now that I recall, they did train in Evansville in 45.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, in 44, the Tigers got off to a fairly slow start. They were, what, fourth or fifth, and then Dick Wakefield got discharged temporarily from the Navy. I guess he was at OCS or something happened, but he rejoined the club and just started hitting at a terrific clip, and that started you on your way, and of course you lost out.
Yes, well, Dick was a real talented ball player, and he provided that spark of the bat that we needed.
Mm-hmm. So the team was not hitting well, not scoring many runs before he showed up? Or?
Well, I don't know whether you can say that Dick did it all himself. It's no different than today, though. Red Sox are leading the league, the American League, in this season.
My club, by the way.
Yes,
I'm a lifelong
yes.
Red Sox fan.
And yet, 30 days ago, there was talk that they were ready to fire Ed Casco.
Right.
So just what the spark is, whether one individual or everybody gets hot.
I see. So I don't think you can.
Yes. Well, I don't know whether when Dick joined, but he certainly didn't hurt us any.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Newhouser and Trout both had tremendous years in 44. And gee, looking at Trout's record, I think he pitched 352 innings, a real workhorse.
Yes.
Did this begin to take its toll on both those fellas down the stretch? Do you think Steve O'Neill was using them too much?
No, I don't think so. No. They're both strong pitchers. Both relied on their fastball. And if you look in the history of baseball, the fastball pitcher, by and large, strains his arm over the course of his career. A
mm-hmm.
Few of them, like Bob Feller, was fortunate to get by without a sore arm. But another fellow on the club, for instance, Virgil Trucks, hard ball thrower, hurt his arm. And if you just trace back in baseball history, hard ball throwers sooner or later catch up with the ravages on that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the terrific strain they put on their arm.
Now, Newhouser.
Both were great pitchers. Both were great
really?
Pitchers. They're, I would say, complete opposites in that Trout would overpower a hitter. And if you hit his best pitch, he'd challenge you to hit it again. And if you did, then he'd challenge it continually, kept on challenging. Newhouser, on the other hand, had a little more finesse. His ball was a riding fastball, a good, sharp, breaking curveball.
So he had a good curve to go with it. Like
and he had a good change to go with it, too.
I see.
Yes. In fact, I remember in the 45 series against the Cubs, went down to the seventh game, and the very first inning we scored 5 runs. And Newhouser was pitching with 1 day rest. And as a second baseman or a shortstop, you can almost sense how long a pitcher is going to last that day, particularly if he's a fastball pitcher. His fastball is rising, his curveball is snapping off. Newhouser started to warm up to Richards, and his curveball was just rolling, and his fastball was fast but straight, wasn't hopping. And as I took my position out there after a few infield tosses, I said, my gosh, I hope Steve has somebody ready, because I don't think Hal will go by 2 or 3 innings.
Uh-huh.
And I looked around the bullpen, and there was Trout and Trucks and Tommy Bridges and Benton, all 4, before the first batter came up for the Cubs, all 4 were warming up. So apparently Steve sensed it too. And so did Richards. Richards is, I'd say, was one of the smartest catchers that I've played with. He sensed Hal's fastball was not sailing or rising. And,
So Newhouser did have a rising fastball,
oh,
not
yes.
A natural sinking fastball.
No, a rising fastball. And Richards sensed what was going on, and for the first 2 or 3 innings, he called for a change of pace on 4 out of 5 pitches. And these Cub batters who had faced Hal twice before in that series were laying way back for that fastball, and they never did get it. And Hal had them all off stride.
Smart
and quite often,
on
yes, oh yes, yeah. And quite often you'll notice that a pitcher gets a second wind, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And about the fourth or fifth inning, Hal got his second win. His fastball came back and it started to sail. And immediately Richard sensed this, and I could see it from my position. And instead of the change of pace, then Richards went almost strictly to the fastball and had the Cubs completely baffled for that ball game.
That's very interesting.
You know the series, how it ended. Tigers, 4 games. Cubs, 3 games.
Right. Yeah. As long as we're talking about the series, your sister that day, she was awfully nice to me. I walked in the Jolly Ox and I told her who I was and that I wanted to see you. And she sat down with me while I was waiting for my meal, which, by the way, was an excellent one. I enjoyed it.
Thanks.
She said that you made the last out of the series and that you ran over and gave the ball to Spike Briggs.
No, I gave it to Steve.
Oh, to Steve O'Neill. Oh.
And then he, in turn, gave it to Mr. Briggs, who was living at the time.
Well, it was a very nice gesture on both your parts. So. Great. Now, you said Trout would just keep challenging hitters. Now,
yes.
Obviously, he must have had some other pitches, otherwise he wouldn't have made it to the majors. I mean, did he have a decent curveball or change?
Oh, yes.
A slider?
He had a forkball.
A forkball.
Forkball, which sinks. That's a boring type of pitch that sinks, and get a lot of ground balls off a fellow like Trout. Newhouser, on the other hand, there are a lot of outfield putouts in his ball game. Here again, I do want to point out the difference between Trout and Newhouser. In a double play situation, we'd go into the mound and we'd set up our strategy and how we intended to play defensively. when you're active, actually playing, perhaps you're so absorbed in every pitch and every play that what might appear shoddy to somebody, the only base running that I can recall as being shoddy was Chuck Hostetler running third base and just lost his footing. That's it, period.
Mm-hmm. Did he trip over the bag, or was it just a question of him taking a tumble?
Taking a tumble beyond the bag. He didn't trip over the bag.
Oh, really?
It was beyond third base, and he just lost his footing and stumbled.
Oh, I see.
So I can't recall anything beyond that as being shoddy. I know one particular play, I singled to left center, and Pafko, who was a great outfielder, ran to his right, backhanded the ball, and I dove head first into second base, and just out by an eyelash. Now, that's considered shoddy, taking extra base.
Right, or his pickup, huh?
Great play on Pafko's part. So, and I can't remember anybody else being thrown on a play in that series.
Mm-hmm.
There was a ball that hopped over Greenberg's shoulder in the sixth game
that
allowed Schuster to score from first base. But Hank knelt down to block the ball, and with a hit, pebble or whatever it hit, and jumped over his shoulder, popped over his shoulder, and rolled to the fence. And before Hank could retrieve the ball, Schuster had scored.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think plays like that are shoddy.
No. Well, I've heard of a few more. I heard that Columbine either, whether it was an error of commission or omission, I don't know, muffed a fly ball or misplayed it or somehow. And there are a few others in the series, but then there have been some horrendous series since then,
right.
Or at least as far as fielding miscues. Remember that 60 series against Pittsburgh and New York, where New York won their three games by scores of 16-1.
I see some of the baseball today, and my gosh, they talk about...
yeah, please, I'd like you to compare it.
Well, I don't want to sound like an old-timer, but it only stands to reason that baseball is diluted today.
Mm-hmm. Because of the expansion?
Expansion, the fact that these fellows do not serve their apprenticeship in minor leagues as we did many, many years ago. Before an average ball player got to the major leagues, it was 4 or 5 years of apprenticeship in the minor leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, when you arrived in the major leagues, you knew the fundamentals of the game. I was in baseball as a coach after through playing days, and I saw high bonus boys coming into the major leagues after spending 1 or 2 years in the minor leagues and didn't know the fundamentals of the game. And I watch some of the games today, and it's apparent that they just don't know the game of baseball.
Anything else? What about the AstroTurf? I mean, he was an injury.
I never played on Astro. I don't know how easy it would be to play on it, but certainly you're not going to get the bad hops with Astro as you will with a diamond that's chopped up.
Sure. But the ball apparently really rockets through there. I've seen them.
Yeah, and then you either do or you don't.
Right, right. Do you mind if I ask you what your salaries were? Apparently the Tigers paid low. Paid low salaries. Do you remember what your salaries were in 43, 44, and 45?
Well, 43, it was 85, and I got up to 12.5
mm-hmm.
After 44,
mm-hmm.
after 44 season, until I finished
that's
in 49.
Great. This one man, Bob Meyer, who was the third baseman in that 45 club, just quit rather than return from what they were going to pay him. He could make more. So
there weren't the high salaries around then that you have today.
Yeah, but, sure.
I believe Newhouser was one of the high salaried ones. I believe he got 40,000 after his good years.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Feller was in the 40 bracket. But then beyond those two, then you could drop right down under 15,000.
Mm-hmm. I see. Apparently there was a big victory celebration on the train back from Chicago after you won?
The victory celebration that we looked forward to just ran out of fuse, I believe. I believe the, and I know I can speak for myself, right after dinner on the train, I had planned to have a champagne party, but I was so exhausted that right after dinner I fell asleep in the bunk.
No kidding.
Yes. And I, there wasn't the jubilation after that. I think we're just spent after seven tough ball games.
See, now apparently there was a, I think Bob Meyer told me you got into Detroit Station about 1 or 2 in the morning. Or
yes.
Around there, and there was a huge crowd.
There was,
10,000
yes.
Waiting for
you. That's right.
Did you get torn to shreds? I mean, were
no.
they after pieces of clothing?
Not really, no.
Mobbed,
but, it was an enthusiastic crowd, and it was a great feeling walking through there, but none of the shirt tearing.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Is there anyone you'd like to comment on, any individuals on those 44 and 45 Tiger clubs? Of course, I could name several, but... Well, for instance, who are your roommates?
Skeeter Webb, generally second base and shortstop. Mm-hmm. For the most part, they generally room together, and they can talk about the defense and get used to one another's mannerisms that you can set up your defense without too much conversation between to eliminate any possibility that the opposition pick up your signs. My roommate was Skeeter Webb.
I see. What about Rudy York? He was a famous player. What do you remember about Rudy?
Rudy was a very talented ball player with the stick, and he was a little minus with the glove, especially on fly balls. I knew anything went up in his direction. Rudy would look around and I'd come on Ed, and I'd have to take care of the fly balls even in foul territory. Rudy was his own worst enemy, that he hit the bottle just a little too much.
Okay, I see.
But I'll say this about him, he is one of the smartest sign stealers that I've ever run across. Rudy can get down to second base, and after two or three pitches, he'd give us a signal that, well, I've got him, and you could rely on him. And you know,
Wally Moses told me that he himself was a guess hitter, that he liked the signs too. Is that true?
Yes, I think you'll find most of the experienced hitters, when I say fellows that know how to hit, that you can give them a sign. And generally, I know when I coached, I never gave the curveball sign, because you could get crossed up by the pitcher or by... He had an easy motion, but he could knock the ball right out of your bat. Awfully, what we call a heavy ball.
He threw a heavy ball.
Yes. But they were great pitchers, both.
And Newhouser had some good seasons after the war, if I recall. But, Trout, let's put it this way. Trout didn't approach his wartime form. Now, do you think that he was pitched out? Because he won, let's see, he won, what, 20, 21 games in 43, 27 to 44, and then came back with 18 and 15. That's 33 decisions in 45.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think by 46 he had it?
No, I don't think so, no.
So he didn't have arm trouble after the war?
He did have arm trouble.
Oh, he did?
Yes, and he went, and he fooled around with the knuckleball.
Mm-hmm.
Hal didn't have his arm trouble until a couple of years later, if I recall. And then he started to fool around with the knuckleball.
Mm-hmm.
But they were great pitchers. They could have pitched at any time. They were good pitchers.
Yeah.
No question about it.
But do you think the Trout had lost most of the stuff by the end of the war? Do you think in 46, 7, and 8, he was just a shadow?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I don't recall exactly when he started to slough off in his victories, but... That's a strange thing in baseball. You can be just as great a pitcher, and if you're not getting those crucial hits at the right time to win the ball game for you, it's no different than Robin Roberts at Philadelphia.
And you were coaching then,
yes, yes. Robbie was a great, great pitcher. And yet if we got one run for Robbie, the team would say, there's your lead, now hold it. And if he wanted any more runs, he'd have to get them himself, hit a home run. But you take Robbie with some of the hard-hitting ball clubs, there's no telling how many ball games he could have won. Robbie was a 20-game winner with 1 and 2 runs at most when he was pitching.
Something, I really won 28 in 1952.
Yes.
So the Tigers came close in 44, and they lost, if I recall, on the last day when Dutch Leonard beat you.
That's right. We were leading by one game going into the last series. Mm-hmm. The Senators were coming in for a four-game series, and we had beaten them 16 out of 18 prior to that last series with them. And we were content, before the series opened, to win just two. We felt that if we had won two, or if we won two, then we'd be in. Meantime, the Yankees were on a hot streak. The Yankees had just beaten Cleveland 4 in a row, and they went into St. Louis. And if you check the records, the Yanks threw 2 four-hitters, 1 three-hitter, 1 two-hitter, and lost all 4 ball games. On the last day of the season, Chet Labs hit 2 home runs, the only 2 home runs he had hit all year. Hit 2 home runs to beat the Yanks, I guess, 4-2, and it was a man on base each time Chet hit the home run. Mm-hmm. So I guess what's to be is to be.
That's right, exactly. That sounds like fate.
And the same park the following year in St. Louis, we won it on the last day with Hank Greenberg's home run.
Oh, was that in St. Louis?
That was in St. Louis.
In St. Louis, okay. That was the day of the rainstorm?
Right, yes.
Was it really that bad?
Oh,
well, Pete Gray and Bob Meyer have told me that you couldn't see the outfield from the plate.
That's right, yes. They had spent a lot of time that day soaking the field with old newspapers and straw and so on. And it let up sometime between 11 and game time. But just prior to game time, then it started to rain hard again. Mm-hmm. And the umpires insisted that we play the games because all 4 clubs in contention could have changed position by a win or 2 losses that day. So Cal Hubbard, behind the plate in St. Louis in our game, insisted that we go ahead and play. Mm-hmm. And after we had won the first game, then the pennant had been clinched. And the Browns had clinched their position, I believe it was third place, I'm not too sure. But since there was no chance of altering our standings between those two clubs, it started to rain real hard in that second game in the call game.
Did the return of Greenberg really give the team a lift?
Oh yes, with Hank's big bat. That had to help.
And the other players weren't jealous of his return.
Not at all.
Gee, this guy's going to cut me out of a job.
Oh, no. But when you feel that someone come in there and help win the pennant, you're all for it. Now, I think the talk about jealousies in baseball, I think it's overemphasized.
Really?
I don't think there's one 100th of what you read about. No such thing.
Just makes good copy.
Yes.
They exaggerate to make good copy. I've read where it was tough for Greenberg to get into shape, that his legs were kind of flabby and he developed blisters in his hands. So
yes.
You were with him day after day. Was it really a chore for him?
Oh, it was, yes. It was. Uh-huh. And he worked hard. He's an industrious type of individual, a perfectionist. And he would be out there every day running, batting. He came to play ball.
Mm-hmm. I guess so. I'd like to move on to the series. I know that Newhouser got clobbered in the first game. Nicholson, whom I interviewed, had a good day. And Dorothy Trucks had pitched only one game before, one game since he got out of the Navy, and then he beat the Cubs, so he must have been doing a lot of pitching in the Navy. For him just to come right out.
Oh, yes, he was, yes. He was in the Navy program, and I understand that all of the boys Pesky and Trucks and all those boys, Johnny Vandermeer, that's all they did. They didn't fight the war, they just played
baseball. Right, played ball. Well, but he must have been good that day.
Yes, yeah.
How did you feel? Well, let's see, I guess you had played in the 36 series, hadn't you? So
yes.
This was your second one, so you may not have been quite as uptight as some of the others. But what's it like, I mean, to know that you've made it, and here's the bunting on the railings, and you're all set to get started. I mean, do you have that kind of knot in your stomach? Or?
Oh, yes, the adrenaline flows at any important series.
Even though you've been around?
Oh, yes. Until that first pitch is thrown. I've seen fellows that bat the first pitch in the season, and you can see their knees shaking. And after that first pitch, then they relax. And I believe anybody who is a competitor is geared up. That's all you're thinking about going into that ball game. Mm-hmm. And after the first pitch or the first ground ball hit you, then it's like taking a glass of water.
Fine. Warren Brown, when asked who he thought would win the series, said, I don't think either team would win. And it was called the World's Worst Series because of some shoddy base running and fielding. Do you think it was that bad?
Oh, I don't think so.
I mean, you have been around since, excuse me,